From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. This week, we have two great guests joining us to talk about some of the important issues going on the Korean Peninsula today, and also taking a look forward to some issues that may come up in the future. Our two guests are both part of the U.S.-Korea Next Gen Scholars Program, which is an initiative by CSIS Korea Chair and USC Dornzive Korean Studies Institute. And the point of this program is to raise the next generation of Korea specialists in the U.S. So we have two guests today who both participated in this program. The first one is Dr. Sheena Greitens. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Missouri. She is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for East Asian Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution and an associate in research at the Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies at Harvard University. And Dr. Greitens participated in the U.S.-Korea Next Gen Scholars Program last year. Our second guest is Lauren Richardson, who is a teaching fellow in Japanese-Korean relations and politics at the Department of Asian Studies of the University of Edinburgh. She recently completed her PhD in international relations and political science at Australian National University and has focused on Japan-Korea relations in her career. I'm really excited to get into a good discussion with these two next-gen scholars, so let's start. So first of all, I want to thank you guys for joining us today. I'm glad that we were able to work out our three different schedules here.
It's great to be here.
Thank you very much.
To start us off, can you both give me an idea of how you became interested in international affairs and in Asia in particular? I guess I'll start with you, Sheena, and then we'll get to you, Lauren.
Sure. So my interest was actually originally familial and personal. My younger sister is adopted from Korea, and she arrived when she was about 6 months old and I was in third grade. And I was just fascinated by what her life had been like before she'd arrived and what it would have been like if she had stayed in Korea. And so my whole family made a real effort to learn about Korea, to celebrate Korean holidays, to get involved in the local Korean-American community growing up, and you know, just to learn as much as we could about the culture and the country that she had come from. And then in college, I had a chance to go and visit South Korea on a study abroad program that Stanford University had just started for a month. And this was in fall of 2002. We were supposed to go to North Korea, to Mount Kumgang, and the trip was canceled because of weather and a change to the family reunion schedule. So we went to the DMZ instead. And I remember looking across the DMZ and thinking about watching the fall of the Berlin Wall on television and really being struck that I, you know, in my sort of naive teenager mind, had had this idea that the Cold War was over everywhere and was sort of fascinated by what I was seeing at the DMZ and started to learn a lot more about the Korean War and about Asia, the sort of the international context of the Korean Peninsula. And so my interest really grew from there. But that was the beginning of it.
Okay, cool. How about you, Lauren?
Okay, so I was educated primarily in my native Australia. And because Australia's major trading partners are all in the Asian region, and also the nation very much perceives itself as part of the region, Asian region, there's naturally a huge focus in our education system on developing Asian literacy. So I began studying Japanese in the first year of high school, which is quite common in Australia. And then once I entered university, I also took up Korean, basically with a view to working in a trade company. But during my undergrad years, I did a study abroad program, and as part of that program, for the first time, I took a course on the history of international relations with a very inspirational German lecturer. And it was at that point that I decided to combine my interest in Asian languages and culture with a disciplinary focus in political science and international relations. And it seemed very natural that having learned Japanese and Korean, that I would focus on the Japan-Korea relationship.
both of you have very different experiences, but it's cool that you have kind of come to this same place with the Next Gen Scholars Program. I want to get into some of these issues that, you know, we talk about a lot in Korea policy. Of course, within the last week or so, everyone's been really focused on North Korea. And Sheena, as someone who has studied North Korea and China, what do you think about the many calls we've been hearing this week for China to do more, for China to take care of the DPRK's belligerents as they continue to test nuclear weapons?
Well, I'll start by saying that I think that the PRC-DPRK relationship is one of the most poorly understood relationships and most consequential poorly understood relationships in international relations today. From my view, it looks to me like North Korea has clearly been an increasing strategic liability to China and to Beijing, in that it has caused major friction, and it's hard to see exactly how the relationship between China and North Korea is contributing positively to Chinese interests at this point. That said, I think that, you know, if you're sitting in Beijing, your primary concern and the sort of the long-standing priority of PRC foreign policy when it came to the Korean Peninsula was to avoid a sort of catastrophic level of instability on the Korean Peninsula, which might be precipitated by Chinese pressure on the DPRK. The problem with that is that in exchange for sort of avoiding this catastrophic scenario, Beijing has been increasingly, I think, had to tolerate a low to mid-level of instability, particularly since about 2012. Increasingly, that is hard. It's hard to see how that serves Chinese interests. And I think that's why you've seen a much more open debate in the last 4 or 5 years about the relationship with North Korea. Netizens and commentators are much more willing to be openly critical of North Korea's behavior, but that's in the sort of unofficial public or semi-official realm, and it doesn't really seem to have affected official behavior yet. Seems to be a lot of inertia in China's DPRK policy, at least so far.
So to follow up on that quickly, do you think there is a tipping point? Is there a point at which it will enter the official realm of China policymakers, that they're, whatever North Korea is doing outweighs the benefit of keeping the status quo?
I would have thought that we'd reached that point, to be perfectly honest. But again, I think this is a really poorly understood relationship, and it's not clear to me that anything's going to change in the future as much as we would like it to.
Right, so turning to Korea's other relationships in the region, Lauren, I know you have mentioned you've studied a lot about the Korea-Japan relationship, and I'm wondering, you know, this week we've been talking about North Korea, and of course Japan has also been threatened in this situation as well. Do you see these two countries working together more as the DPRK becomes more belligerent? Do you see this pushing Japan and Korea together?
I do think it's likely that Japan and Korea will cooperate more on the North Korean security threat now, but not simply as a consequence of Pyongyang ratcheting up its provocations. It's more because the two governments have, in recent months, ironed out some of the major diplomatic issues that have served to impede their strategic cooperation up until now. So I'm talking, of course, about issues pertaining to Japan's historical legacy on the Korean Peninsula, the so-called history problems, the biggest of which has been the comfort women issue. So as you would already know, the two leaders recently signed a pact that's supposed to, you know, resolve this issue. So that said, I think the main arena of cooperation on North Korea is likely to just continue to be intelligence sharing, and also coming up with a unified sanctions policy. But this won't be done bilaterally, but with the U.S.
Right. Yeah, we actually last week had a conference here at KEI that the topic was trilateral U.S.-Japan-Korea relations. And so we were talking about all these different ways in which, and this is, of course, before the nuclear test. So, you know, the whole thing has changed now, of course. Do you see any particular openings that you think would be, you know, maybe not necessarily on the security realm, not necessarily on the history realm, but are there other things that Korea and Japan could be doing more to cooperate and build on this relationship?
Of course, I mean, economic relations have always been strong, and there's always been a lot of platforms there. But to be honest, with the current leadership of Abe in Japan and Park Geun-hye, I think any cooperation under these two current governments is just going to be really limited. I think it's quite amazing that they came to this Comfort Women deal, and it may be more when there's a leadership change on either side or both sides that we could expect they will cooperate more, expand their maybe diplomatic cooperation.
I also want to ask you guys about another big issue that has been in the news and we've been talking about a lot regarding the peninsula and the region, and that's of course THAAD. So what are your thoughts on the system, especially given the fifth nuclear test this week? And I'll start with you, Lauren, this time.
Okay. So the decision to deploy THAAD was somewhat inevitable, given the increasing pace and sophistication of North Korea's nuclear weapons program, and also given that South Korea really had no indigenous mechanism to destroy any of these missiles. But at the same time, I think that the most recent test and this ratcheting up of provocations by North Korea, I don't think that's surprising, given that THAAD was deployed. I don't think THAAD was ever intended to sort of curb provocations. And I think it's expected that North Korea would respond to THAAD by, ratcheting up its nuclear weapons campaign. So I think what we see is, the emergence of a vicious cycle that North Korea has been developing its nuclear weapons capabilities, South Korea is responding by implementing THAAD. Now North Korea is responding in turn by ratcheting up its provocations. And I don't see how this vicious cycle will be overcome. I think the only factor that could sway this cycle or shape it in any way is China. And I'm sure Dr. Greitens could talk more about that.
Yeah, so what do you think?
I think that the decision makes a lot of sense for the reasons that Lauren mentioned. I also think it was, a long time coming and foreseeable given the level and frequency of North Korean provocations of various types, nuclear and missile, since in 2011, 2012. And so, for that reason, for South Korea, I think it makes a lot of sense for South Korea to pursue a primarily defensive system that allows the Korean people to defend themselves. As far as China, I know that some of the discussion has centered around China's opposition to the deployment of THAAD, but at this point, it's a little bit hard to see what other options provide an equivalent level of protection. Relying on China hasn't worked. And Park Geun-hye, early in her presidency, put a lot of effort toward building the relationship with Beijing. And at this point, I think it put South Korea, understandably, in a very difficult position, having invested a lot in trying to build this relationship with Beijing early on. But when that doesn't work and the provocations and the ability to threaten South Korea continue to build, I think it's a necessary step to go ahead and take measures to defend South Korea and the South Korean people.
Right. So, we talked about a couple of these issues that are happening now, but I also want to look forward a little bit. As I mentioned, where you two are both part of the Next Gen Scholars Program, and that's, of course, focused on bringing up the next generation of Korea and Asia scholars. So with that forward-looking mindset, what would you say is one issue that we aren't focused on as much at the moment, but we probably should be, or an issue that you think will become a big issue looking forward to the future?
Sure. I think there are two issues. One that I think we should be focusing more on now, and then one that's a sort of an interesting issue that I've just started looking at for the future. The issue that I think still needs a lot of work now is that the internal politics and the dynamics of non-democratic systems of dictatorships like North Korea, of single-party regimes like China's, are still pretty poorly understood. And I think there's a lot of creative work that we could do and a lot of tools that we have that we could apply to understanding domestic politics in those countries better. and that would help us understand a lot and do a better job of predicting what North Korea is likely to do in the future. And I think that understanding the link between domestic politics in these countries and their international relations is a sort of the big picture issue that I think the region should pay more attention to, because it drives a lot of the politics and the developments in the region. It's one of the reasons I was originally fascinated by East Asia and by the Korean Peninsula, is that so much has gone well there in terms of economic growth and democratization, and yet there are real challenges still to resolve. And a lot of those challenges actually center, to my thinking, on the domestic politics of the countries in question, and particularly North Korea. But I think understanding some of the domestic and social changes that are taking place in South Korea as well are going to be really important for keeping the U.S.-Korea relationship in a really good place in the years to come. It's a tough question to answer because the choice is, there are so many interesting questions to look at. It's hard to know which one to pick.
Right. Yeah. What do you think, Lauren?
My response would complement Sheena's in that I focus more on the democratic regimes in the region. And I think that one thing that's going to change things, it's changing things now and also in the future, is the increasing political liberalization in South Korea, particularly. And so what I'm referring to specifically is the separation of powers between the judiciary in Korea and the executive branch of government. And so what we've seen in very recent years is victims of Japanese colonial policies in Korea suing their own government through the judiciary, and very successfully. And this is having all kinds of implications for not only state-society relations within South Korea, but also South Korea's relations with Japan. And, you know, it's undermined the treaty they signed in 1965, and I think very much the recent Comfort Women deal came as a result of these lawsuits. So I think that, you know, for decades, a really state interests have dominated relations within the region. But I think with as political liberalization continues within the region, not just in South Korea, we're likely to see more citizen interests appear on the diplomatic agendas, such as the Comfort Women issue, there's other issues too, and more generally the rise of powerful citizens movements. Yeah, that's all.
Yeah, really, that's really interesting. I don't know what I was expecting you guys to say, but that's not necessarily what I was expecting you guys to say. So it's really interesting to have these conversations. If I can ask you this question, when we were talking and trying to find, you know, some people to join us on the talk, and we ended up with the two of you, I was actually really excited because, you know, as a woman who's interested in international affairs, it's a little bit rare to have a talk with two awesome female scholars who are interested in Asia and interested in Korea. And I'm wondering if the two of you have any thoughts, any insights. Have you seen the role of women in this field improving since you entered the field, I guess? Do you have any thoughts or advice for young women who are looking to enter international affairs? What do you think about that?
So first, I would say East Asia is a fantastic place to do research as a female researcher. It's been a terrific experience in any number of ways. So that's the first thing I would say. It should make people and young women who are interested in studying East Asia really optimistic. It's a great field to go into. In terms of advice or suggestions, I would, you know, I would say, figure out what matters, what the top priorities are, and stay really, really focused on those. It's easy to get pulled in a lot of different directions, and so staying focused on the most important things, I think, is really important. And the second is to find good role models and mentors. I was really lucky in graduate school to be mentored by a fantastic committee chair, Professor Elizabeth Perry at Harvard, who studies Chinese politics, and also to be able to work with a number of male professors who are really supportive of women in the field doing research. Victor Cha, David Kong, some of my other committee members at Harvard, Ian Johnston, who works on China as well. There are lots of people out there who want good research and want women to succeed and to have a voice in these research conversations. And so finding those people, learning from their example and listening to their advice, I think is really important. And the opportunity to have that kind of support, mentorship, and those good role models is fortunately there. Again, I think that what that means is that people can be optimistic about pursuing this as a research field. I think it's a great place to be working right now. And again, East Asia is a really important, exciting, dynamic region with a lot of really interesting work to be done. So there's plenty of opportunity for somebody who wants to jump in, learn the language, spend time there, and to do the work. So I don't know, Lauren, what's your take?
I would certainly echo Sheena's sentiments on East Asia being such a fascinating place to live and study. And as a very early career researcher, I only just submitted my PhD very recently, I can't really comment on the trends in the number of women in the field, but I can certainly offer advice to young women aspiring to a career in international affairs. In my capacity as a teacher at university, I often encourage my international relations students to apply for the various young leaders programs, such as the US Korea Next Gen program, CSA Asian Leaders, because these programs are really designed as gateways to careers in policy and also in the academe. But invariably, I find that it tends to be the male students who come forth and say, I'd like to apply, could you support me? A lot of the female students, I find, sort of hold back on the premise that they're not ready yet, or they need to do further study, develop their skills. So I would encourage any female students to just grab opportunities when they present themselves, to trust that they'll develop the necessary skills for a career in international studies through such programs rather than having it all set beforehand. And it's also really important to work on developing a unique and a valuable skill set, including foreign language acquisition, and these sort of things will increase your chance of being accepted into the many great programs out there.
I would agree with all of that.
Great. So I know that, you know, Sheena, you have to get going. So if I can just ask you really quickly, is there anything else that you think would be important to say or for our listeners to know about Asia at the moment?
Gosh, can I loop back to question four and throw one more thing in there that I think is really interesting and going to be important? So one of the other issues that is sort of latent in the region and in global politics that I think may become very important is what's gradually turning into a global community of North Korean refugees and defectors. So there are, as probably most of the people listening know, the largest community of people who've left North Korea is resettled in South Korea, about 28,000 people at last count. And so that's the sort of the primary focus of looking at North Korean defectors and refugees the resettlement and integration challenges. But we're also actually now seeing North Korean refugees resettled in Europe, in the UK, in the United States, and I believe in Australia as well. And so you have a sort of parallel Korean diaspora being created that has the potential also to be fairly symbolically important in thinking about North Korea policy when it comes to issues like the resolutions that have been passed on human rights and trade issues and security issues. I think that group may be small in size, but potentially quite consequential. And it's something that's just starting to take place, to be created. And I think it'll be very, very interesting to see how that community develops. So I've actually just started a new project to kind of look at the North Korean communities in these places and to look at how they might eventually influence policies toward North Korea in the countries where the communities exist. So that's one of the issues that is under the radar now that I think is worth looking at in the future.
Okay, great. Lauren, what do you think? Is there anything else that you would want to say as a wrap-up?
As a wrap-up, I think often There's a tendency for East Asia watchers or the general public around the world to be really alarmed by any developments happening in East Asia. But I think that often when these very worrying developments occur, like the recent nuclear tests, also frictions between the Japanese and South Korean government, that it's often, you know, we're moving closer to a resolution over some of these, you know, problems that have just been simmering for so long, really since the Korean War. So often things have to get quite bad for any progress to be made.
Thank you both so much for your time, for your flexibility, and for joining us today.
Jenna, thanks so much for having us. It was a great discussion.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us here on Korean Context. We have a lot of great guests lined up for the fall, so be sure to keep track of our podcast by subscribing on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. And tune in again next week for another great episode.